share for the opportunity. No, Chair, I think the issue was also right. I just want to apologize on behalf of the Deputy Minister in the room. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. DG? You will note, DG, that the documents are being circulated now. We will not necessarily be familiar with everything you will be doing. We may not do justice to engaging with the documentation, but we will do our best to make sure we are at the same wavelength. Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Thank you very much to the honorable members. I'm coming with the Chief Land Claims Commissioner, Mr. Blessing Mpela, together with DDG Mdu Shabane and Commissioner Sibuka, as well as our acting CFO Vusi Mashang. You know the parliamentary officer that support us. The questions that we were asked to come and respond to give additional information on were, one, the redistribution of 30% of white-owned agricultural land by 2014 about meeting the target. The second one was about the issue of the preliminary plan for surveying of state land. And then the third one was the briefing on Ingonyama Trust for the completeness of that information, and the briefing on the Commission of Land Rights Annual Report. It was more on the CPA. So those are the four questions that we asked to report on, and that's what we'll do. On the first item, the redistribution of white-owned agricultural land, we have made a presentation which just summarizes and characterizes the problem. And a copy has been distributed. A copy of that has been distributed. What we are saying in this is that we have delivered about 5 million hectares of the 30%, which is the 30% of the white-owned agricultural land, which amounts to 24.9 million hectares. So we have delivered about 5 million hectares, which means that we are left with about 19 million hectares up to the end of the 2014. We have done the analysis of what we have done in terms of delivery, and we have said that if we are going to deliver according to this, we would need to deliver about 3 million hectares per year up to 2014. And we just did an analysis. If you turn to slide number 3 of our this presentation that I'm talking to, you will see there that we have indicated that if we talk about this year of this annual report that we had presented to you, we were supposed to deliver 1.5 million hectares during that year, and we had to adjust our targets from 1.5 million hectares to about 647,000 hectares in line with what was provided to us. And even that year, we reported to you that we could not deliver that 647,000 hectares. We only delivered, according to that annual report that we gave you, 443,000 hectares, which meant that that was the money that we had allocated. And that money gave us, we spent 99.9% of that budget on land acquisition in the year that I'm talking about, which we reported to you. And our projections that we had given were that we would be needing 3.3 billion to deliver 914,000 hectares in 2009-2010, And 2010, 2011, we would need 3.7 billion to deliver 954,000 hectares, 164. And so for the following year. But what we said was that if we're going to do this on slide four, we would need a total amount of 71 billion to be able to deliver according to this by 2014. So in slide four we have demonstrated how that would have to happen. And what we have said is because of this we had done a scenario planning which was looking at what is possible given these circumstances. And in that scenario planning, I think if you go to slide number six, we started to say if we're going to look at the level of funding that we have and look at the ability to buy, the amount that we are able to buy, amount of land that we're able to buy, we would need to revise not the target. The target remains 30%, which is our mandate. That is what we've been mandated to do as this government. But we would need to revise the time for that, that it may not be possible within 2024. But if we look, this was not based on the mandate, this 2025, but it was based on the current level of funding with an escalation of, say, about the inflation rate. The current level of funding would enable us to buy this land over an extended period, and that period would go to 2025. And we think that that would be giving us the line of achieving this over an extended period. It was based purely on what is the current level of funding, what is the current land prices. And we are saying that the land prices are a big issue because if you are buying land at the current land prices, it would make significant changes. And we gave this explanation that the land prices were about 3,000 rand a hectare for grazing land about 3, 4, 5 years ago. But today, that land price is about 7,000 rand per hectare. And in some areas, it becomes 10,000 rand per hectare. And if you go to other areas, such as KZN sugarcane estates, you find that the land is about 55,000 to 60,000 rand per hectare. And if you come to the Western Cape here, the land per hectare is about 100,000. So I think that if you consider land prices that are increasing, it is going to be increasingly difficult to do this within this short period. So that explains, Chairperson, our rationale for the achievement of the target. And I think I would leave that at that. You asked us what was the basis of not achieving this, and we said that this is the explanation. And if I come to the second question,
Minister, if you want to add anything or ladies and gentlemen, honourable members, there is a response to the question. We know and we also read that the department itself is looking at alternative ways of trying to meet the target. And they are saying if they exclude the alternative ways and focus on the current willing buyer, willing seller approach, this is the scenario. Of course, the DG has said that there are various scenarios, and this is one scenario they have presented to us. I noted three hands already, honorable members.
No, Chair, that's one to give it to the other members will come back.
Okay. I've noted two hands, then mine of yours. Honorable Dilip.
Thank you, Chairperson. Sorry for coming a few minutes late. I know you always start on time. I just want to understand how you determine the prices. DG, you mention inflation. Inflation is a factor. And the other estimate that you are using is market related prices. I just want to understand how you arrive at these the average prices and whether inflation, you're also projecting possible inflation targets in the future. Thank you.
Honourable Steyn.
Thank you, Chair. And I also want to thank the department for coming to this meeting as we requested them, and also thanking them for all the information that I'm sure we've received from them. My question is, at this stage, if the department is dealing, I know there was other discussions regarding the price of the land itself, and also the high prices of land, because if we speak to people, there doesn't seem to be, some people say that it's true that it does happen, and others say it's not true that the prices is inflated. But if they are speaking to, for instance, banks and other people to come up with this, we are working on a amount, estimated amount, that I want to check if the figures are checked against some other institutions or banks or other organizations for this amount.
Honorable member.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to ask the DG, you know, when he presented to the Appropriations Committee, he mentioned that, you know, that the determination of the price is based on sworn valuations. I just want to know from him whether, you know, the valuators are qualified. In other words, are they, you know, qualified sworn valuators? Secondly, Chair, he also mentioned at that meeting that as many as three times they do valuations to come to a price which is satisfactory to both the buyer and the seller. Do we pay for all three valuations? Do we pay the individual? And do we continue? Will we have a fourth and a fifth valuation if we don't get to the price that the seller wants? Just those questions.
Honorable Steyn.
Thank you,
very much, Professor, and thank you very much, DG. And I also like to welcome our minister today. Mine is actually with regard, I just want to extend my question towards supporting the Honorable Dili with regard to arriving at that price, because you indicated that the price is too high, and you also questioned the willing buyer, willing seller. So I just wanted to find out the base. If you are saying the price is too high, how do you compare that price? What method are you using to know that it is high or it is low compared to the market price? Thank you.
Can you start with the last one, because I think you did address the last question. Go ahead.
Yes, Chair. Thank you very much to the honorable members. This is related to how we arrive at the price that we pay, and I want to deal with the question that says, how do we get there? We use the valuers, and the valuers are registered. In the valuation, we demand that the valuer must show evidence that he's registered with the valuer council, and all of them do. So we accept valuations from valuers. But I did present a challenge that a lot of the valuers, this profession, our history tells us that it is an untransformed profession, where it is old white males that are dominating this, and that is the one of the issues that relate to this. And those valuers will come with the price. I gave the example to the appropriation committee that you get one property. That property, you get three different valuations. You get the first valuation, they say the property is 2 million. You get to the second valuation, they say the property is 3 million. You get to the third valuer, it says the property is 7 million. All of them are professionally qualified valuers. And they argue that they use different methods of valuation, but they come to different values of the same property, unaltered, unimproved. So that's the thing. We take that to the land claims court, And we've got some judgments of various cases where the Land Claims Court has said, and the avaluers have argued also, that valuation is not an exact science. So what does that mean? It means that you can come up with different figures for the same property, depending on what method you have used. And when we brought this problem to the Council of Valuers, they said their norm is that 10% should be the difference between one valuer and the other. In other words, if it's 2 million, it can only be 10% higher or 10% lower, and that's the going rate that we should accept. But if the valuers are different, and the landowners are given the right to review the valuation that we can make, and they come with different valuers, and that's the challenge. So the short answer is that we use the valuers as the basis of arriving at the price, and they use comparative sales. They use comparative sales when they do the valuation. Now, the challenge is, if we are going to use that method, which is said to be scientific, how come that you've got these three different prices for the same property? That's the challenge of this thing. So I'm saying, we are told that the prices they use are market-related prices. It leads me to the second question. Do we benchmark and do we use the comparatives from other institutions, such as banks? We have tried to do this. We have even appointed a valuer who could assist us in this. And that valuer came with the conclusion that the prices that are paid by the banks, because the banks are looking at the productive value of the farm, and they cannot pay much, much higher than those productive values of the farm. So, but the farmers do not accept these productive values of the farm. This is what, if you are going to compare these values with what is stated in the SARS report, which talks to what is it that the values of their properties, they do not accept those kind of comparatives. This is why we are saying we probably need a debate and a reflection on what is acceptable. Because I reported to the committees that when the farmers sell to one another, they are not paying these kind of prices that they are demanding from government. But once they know it is government selling, and we said that experience is not uncommon. It is not unique to South Africa. This was done in Kenya. This was done in Brazil. So this is why we're saying we call for a review on this process, so that we can do something different. I think I've answered the second question.
I would just like to find out, in terms of evaluating the land, do you separate the value of the land from the top structures that's on the land, the improvements, whatever the farmer has built on the land, and deal with the top structures separately? So did you only deal with the value of the land? Is the top structure included in the so-called market-related prices?
Yes, it is included, because we are taking the whole farm, so all the improvements that are on that farm, whether it is the dams or the irrigations or the houses. But what we have said is that when we value the house on a farm, you can't value it as though it's in Constantia or Sandton. Even if you've got a double-story house on a farm, the valuers value that farm as a house, a farm manager's house. Not as, you can't fetch the value of Constantia or of Sandton on a farm. It doesn't matter how that house looks so good. It is a farmhouse for a manager. So the valuers then supposed to give that as the value of the farm, and not give the urban values to farm properties. That is the way we approach it.
Chair. Thank you very much.
You still have the platform. Mr. Lille interrupted with permission. I'm not giving you the permission to interrupt.
Chair, I think I've answered all the questions unless you say I must go to the second item, which I will.
Honourable members, the information in front of us has been deliberated upon, if you recall, several times before, especially when we had the commissioner. The committee's approach, Honourable Minister, has been that when you're dealing with a captive market like restitution, the approach would be different than when you're dealing with redistribution. Precisely because under redistribution, the department can be regarded as a bulk buyer in the context of influencing the price, as opposed to restitution, when restitution is a particular farm that is being claimed, and you cannot have an alternative other than perhaps other alternative methods of compensation. But that land becomes the key focus. We are not sure whether Treasury has been exposed to that debate, whether Expropriation Committee has been exposed to that debate, because in our view, when the money is allocated to the department for land acquisition, the budget would be different for restitution and different for redistribution. I want Honorable Sogoni and Treasury, perhaps you would enter the fray now before we move on to the second aspect of our question.
Not sure. Don't clap me with the with Treasury.
We're not clapping you, we're just giving you the platform.
Okay, thank you, Chair. No, thanks very much, Chair. Maybe just first to recognize the Minister. I didn't see him. This table is too long. Except to say I'm just disappointed that Honorable Delil has taken 360 degrees. She used to say land first now. She seems to have tamed down.
In this committee, we do not allow party politics to play a role.
Okay.
Don't bring that.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I withdraw. Now, Chair, but I just want to. The DG says when this 30% issue came on the agenda, I think that it was, I don't know if I got him well, that it was related to the price at a particular time. So now it means that the price changed in the interim between the time 30% was put on the floor. Is that the understanding that perhaps, I mean, that the prices were changed as a result of the, obviously, market is related to issues of demand. The more you demand, the more the market shifts to what we call the goalpost. And if that is the case, if we're talking about market, do we see a role, for instance, for government in terms of intervening in that situation? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Andrew Donaldson from the National Treasury. And let me also just say that it is a privilege to be at this committee. It's a little unusual for Treasury to come to portfolio committee meetings like this. But we did discuss this with Minister Gordhan. He certainly wanted us to communicate the Treasury very much recognizes the priority of land redistribution and rural development amongst the five or six top priorities that government has set for itself, and that is set out in the medium-term budget statement that was tabled by the Minister of Finance last week. And so it is a welcome opportunity for us to join your committee this morning. On the question of the separate budgeting treatment of land restitution and land redistribution, land reform. Yes, going back several years now, the budget has specifically separated amounts for the restitution program and for land reform. They are separate programs in this vote. And if we go back to 2001, 2002, when we were beginning to make progress with the restitution program, DG will confirm that at that stage we envisaged a completion of the land restitution program by about 2008. And you'll see if you go back in the historical budget line, the allocation for restitution was stepped up very considerably in 2003 and 2004 with a view to completing the restitution program in 2008-2009. But it has turned out that the restitution program has been very much more expensive in its final stages than was anticipated. And it has only really in the last year or two become clear that the approach that has been adopted to the settlement of the final 3,000 or 4,000 rural claims, the approach has been that has been adopted implies a very much higher cost to the fiscus than had been planned. And so where for budget purposes, and you'll see this reflected in the budget documents of 2005 and 2006, where the intention was that land restitution would be completed by about 2009, and that allocation on the budget would then phase down in favor of a significant step up in land reform and land redistribution allocation, we have actually had to continue to spend the money on restitution. And there is still, it turns out, a very substantial outstanding cost of completion of the restitution program that has to be budgeted for. And so I think that the need that we now have to review the targets that have been set has to be understood in the context of that very considerable rise in the in practice in the cost of land restitution as it has been implemented. And so I think the DG is quite right that that we need to review our approach. I think that has to be quite a wide-ranging review, and there's some indication of that in the medium-term budget statement. Our approach to both the land redistribution and land reform and the restitution program, I'm happy to say a few things about what might be the elements of that, but that is perhaps a wider discussion. But I would just put this on the table, that we now recognize that particularly in the communities that have been identified as beneficiaries of the land restitution program, the outstanding rural claims that are in just some parts of the country, there is a need to recognize the substantial role of municipal infrastructure and municipal services in addressing the needs of those communities. And so the approach to restitution is going to need to recognize a greater complementarity between the land restitution spending and municipal services and municipal infrastructure, investment in the kinds of facilities that make income-generating opportunities for communities possible, that open up economic opportunities, and in particular, of course, links with agricultural support and the role of agricultural credit and extension services in making land restitution and, in due course, land redistribution programs projects viable. And so we welcome the opportunity to review the mechanisms, the programs, the linkages between the land spending and agricultural development, but also importantly municipal grants and municipal service delivery spending. In all of these areas there are substantial backlogs and challenges that government faces, and so we face budget constraints, but we think this is a good opportunity to learn from the lessons of the projects that have been implemented, those that have succeeded, those that perhaps have not succeeded or been as successful as we would have liked, learn from those lessons in adopting a new approach to both the completion of the restitution program and the land reform program. Thank you.
We would be very interested in engaging with Treasury on the review process. Well, it is a responsibility of this committee to understand the components of the review process and how we can engage with that process so that we can come to a workable solution. Because in our own view, as we differentiate between restitution and redistribution pricing structure, we also want to engage in the restructuring of the components of the land being bought. You would recall Treasury Auditor General has punitively put a disclaimer on the department for acquiring proactively going concerns. And we are of the opinion that that punitive action is in fact prohibitive, and it creates an impression that the farm must be stripped naked first before it can be acquired, so that the beneficiaries must start from scratch developing a farm when a farm has already been developed. And this is why I think, although the minister is whispering that I should not push him into a corner yet, I think that the committee is interested in defending the assets as they stand, rather than to strip the asset naked first before you can acquire it. And we believe that it could create an additional cost unintended. And that is why I would want to engage with Treasury on this matter, because it is important for us to make sure that the fiscus you are preserving, it is also our responsibility to help you preserve it. Thank you very much. I have noted three hands, fourth one now, but the minister wants a follow-up on your contribution in Treasury. I'll keep your hand in abeyance at the present moment, and Honorable Dandala's hand as well, together with Ms. Stein's follow-up question, until the minister has intervened. Thank you.
Chair, thanks very much. I think it's correct for me to respond, because I am responsible for that review, not Treasury. Members of the House will remember that they asked this question last week, and I answered it. Now, there is nothing different fundamentally to what Mr. Donaldson is saying. What is different is that he is starting to give details that is not supposed to be the case at this moment, because it might conflict with what government or cabinet would do in terms of the details led by us as a department. It's a political function. That is, I just wanted members so that we don't record here that which he said, and then when you see it next time, and you're not going to ask him, you're going to ask me correctly. And you're not going to ask the Minister for Finance, you're going to ask the Minister for Rural Development and Land Reform. It's a matter of protocol. Let me therefore respond by saying, and repeating what I was saying in the House, that government policy at the moment remains the same, that 2014 is the target. But that target, given the circumstances, is under review. I have not given detail. I will not give detail now. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Minister. At our own appropriate time, we will engage with the Minister. The real reason why we came on the offer by Mr. Donaldson was because their point of view, when they are confronted with a request by the department, would help us to understand where they come from. And for us to engage with them on where they would contradict your point of view when you're requesting additional amount of money, it would be relevant for us to have an understanding of that when the matter is tabled in Parliament. However, we will be led by you in this regard, in terms of what you will table, and then we'll engage them. It will be helpful for us to see what you will have as the product of the review before Treasury allocates funding to that, so that we can engage with that. Thank you very much, Minister, on that response. I'll entertain the three additional hands now. Don't regard your question as irrelevant simply because the Minister has responded. Whatever question you had, put it on the table. Honourable Member?
Yes, you.
Thank you, Chairman.
Dr. Rabi.
Chairman, my question's got two aspects to it. First and foremost, they say that the state is one of the largest single bodies that own land in this, in South Africa. I don't know, but isn't it possible, and then I'm talking about in the Western Cape, quite a number of municipalities have got large commonages. They have common ground there in Tabor, which I think is suitable for small-scale agricultural development. Have they investigated that? And then secondly, Chairman, it's often said by our organized agriculture that the dialogue between this particular department and organized farming is not what it should be. Has any attempts been made to improve the dialogue or the communication between these two respective bodies? Thank you, Chairman.
Honourable Dandana.
Thank you, Chair. I was thinking of withdrawing my question, but after your comment, I thought I would ask it nonetheless. You will decide whether it should be answered here or perhaps debated elsewhere. What I'm interested to know is whether historically there are reasons for the government not to have developed, in negotiation with the farming bodies, a fixed formula that hopefully would enable all of us, including the people who are selling the land, to actually know that there is a formula that for the land, for you not to lose, and for the government and the people not to be disadvantaged, here is a reasonable position on which we agree. And then another formula for the developments that are on those properties to ensure that, as you correctly said, the farms are not stripped naked before they are passed on. I think the essential thing I'm wanting to know is, rather than being stalled by these market prices when everybody wants to move on this issue with an understanding of what damage will happen to the country if this is not resolved, has it not been, why have, historically, have there been reasons why we have not moved to a position of a reasonably fixed formula? Honourable Gapan. Thank you, sir. I'm sorry, Honourable Dandana, Chair, have covered me, because I was just going to say to the Minister, just to give him the position without attending this. This is an issue we have been dealing with in this committee of expert behavior of farmers working with the government. So when they're asking this, I'm not sure that there is no answer to my assessment.
Thank you very much.
Noble Stein, you want a second bite?
Thank you, Chair. This is a follow-up from the first one that I've asked. I've also read somewhere that, and I think up till now, the department has spent about 28 billion rand on restitution. My figures might be wrong here. But my question is the biggest chunk, and I did ask the minister this in writing, so if they can respond here, they don't have to respond to me. The biggest chunk of that, as I understand, must have been paid out then to claims for financial compensation. So I think I want to come to a point where I think the department, the planning that was set aside for this, if the department did plan for this, if we said the restitution was to be finalized in 2008, but up to I don't know which year, most of the money was spent on financial compensation, not really buying land, there must have been a planning period that we didn't pick up this last few thousand plans that's actually to buy land itself. So I just want to find out from the department, when did they pick up that there could be a problem? It couldn't happen only this year or last year. There must have been a period prior to this. And then just my last question is also with the terms that the department have settled. I still don't understand the word settled. Does settled mean that we've now come to an agreement, the claim is valid, we are going to buy it? Is that settled? There's another term when it's actually bought and everything is. So I want to find out how many of these claims are still not settled, where we've agreed that we're going to come to a point. So do we know that there's 4,000 claims that still need to be settled? How many of them settled? So I just need to find out. I'm talking about planning here. Where are we with that amount so that we can come to some kind of a understanding at today's value? How much is it going to cost?
I take note that some of the questions fall within the ambit of the review process and therefore cannot be regarded as a valid answer now, because they will be relevant only when the process has been finalized, the review process. Because as the minister has indicated, the current policy is the one which has been used all along. The new alternative methods have not kicked in because they are subject of the reviewer. But yes, DG, your platform is yours.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Yeah, we would appreciate any inputs during this review process, whether it's to look at the policy and the manner in which we would settle these land issues going forward. We have made an open invitation to everyone, including the farmers themselves, that we would welcome those inputs from the farmers. This leads me to this question that relates to whether we are interacting with the farmers or not. We have been had sessions with the farmers. We are interacting with them where we have made these open invitations. A month ago, I've been interacting with them at the R3SA Congress, where we spoke to all of the farmers there, asking them to help us. We were discussing specifically these issues that relate to the land prices and the cost of land reform in general. And that was the invitation that was made very open to all of them. Minister had sessions with the farmers where they were talking some of these relevant issues to review of the land process. There was a meeting where they had discussed these issues, where Minister said we need to get some inputs from you about how can we resolve this matter about land prices. Yes, we would welcome those inputs. On the question of the states being the largest landowner, there have been distortions about this. A lot of farmers are saying that we must give land for land reform from the state land. And the reality is that there is not adequate state land for land reform. The state does own some land. Most of it was in the SADC, the South African Development Trust, in the hands of that organization. We have analyzed that land and we found that about 3 million hectares were available for land redistribution. The rest of the state land is in the communal areas, still recorded as state land. And that land is already congested. If you go to any of the ex-owned areas, you will find that there is congestion there because of the population growth. That is also recorded as state land. In fact, it makes up what 13% we've been talking about all these years. In our land reform program, we have redistributed about 50% of that land available for land reform. As I say, it's 3 million. I told you that the outstanding amount of land that we still need to redistribute is 19 million. So 3 million is very insignificant compared to that 19 million that we have still to redistribute. Now, coming to this role of municipalities, we welcome that. In fact, part of the review is that when we do redistribution and restitution, using the CRDP principles, which we outlined to you when we introduced the Comprehensive Rural Development Program, this is what will be covered in that approach. We are saying the participants to that framework are the municipalities, provincial governments, national governments, and the private sector, so that they can have input as to how to contribute to sustainable use of that land when we transfer it to the people. They fix the formula. This would be welcomed as part of the contribution to the review. There's been a long debate. It was discussing this formula that led to the Section 25 of the Constitution, which was an attempt to give a formula of what you take into account when you arrive at the compensation. That matter is clearly a subject of the review. And then the issue of the spend on restitution, we have done this analysis that about 80% of the restitution claims were urban claims, and most of the life of the commission has been settling claims which are urban claims and where most of it was financial compensation. We realized this even during the 2003, 2004, 2005 period, that the rural claims are complex claims. We did the analysis of that, where we found that there were forestry claims, sugarcane estates, and all of those types of land that is affected by the restitution claims. So we are saying that the review process is going to look at this, how we should deal with these complex rural land claims that are outstanding. They are obviously much more costlier than the urban claims on which we have spent most of the money to date. I think that just to say that under settled and finalized, when we have signed an agreement with the landowner, with the claimant, about the manner in which that claim is to be settled, and we have agreed on that, we regard that as a settled claim. But when we have implemented what is in that settlement agreement which we have entered into with the claimant, we consider that a finalized claim. So that's the distinction between this. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It settles the first answer to the call to the department. Honorable Sogoni wants to take a contingent of the appropriation committee out of this meeting. They don't like to be spectators. They used to be in charge, and now we have reduced them to be spectators. Yes. They don't like that. You are allowed and choose, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much.
Not really, Chairperson, except that you're not talking money strongly. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yes, it's really. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Treasury, we had said that one of the purposes of this meeting would be to engage with Treasury on your strategic view about why you fund the department in the manner in which you do. You have dealt with an aspect of that, but the other aspect relates to the reason why the mandate has to be shifted because of the availability of funding from Treasury to the department. And perhaps we'll give this opportunity and give the DG a bit of a rest so that we engage with Treasury on this matter. You want to take the matter up?
Well, thank you, Chair. Chair, I do need to emphasize that Treasury does not make allocations. Cabinet makes allocations. Mm-hmm. The Minister will confirm that the Cabinet has, in fact, not yet discussed the allocations for the 2010 budget framework. The broad framework that is set out in the MTBBS provides an overall envelope, a discussion of the macroeconomic environment within which the budget has to be framed, and sets out in broad terms the government priorities as they relate to spending allocations. But Cabinet has still to discuss and decide on next year's national department allocations. In broad terms, as is set out in the MTBBS, government faces substantial demands in many areas. The priorities of government, job creation, strengthening the economic performance of the economy, strengthening our education system, addressing the very profoundly important challenges in our health system, broadening participation in the economy, rural development, sustaining infrastructure investment. All of these are areas in which there are substantial spending requirements on the state, and in which the downturn in the economy now, the slowdown in revenue obviously creates challenges for government in meeting all of these obligations. So there are difficult balances to be struck in each of these areas. That's the challenge that the Cabinet has to deal with in finalizing budget allocations for next year and beyond. But I would like to emphasize, as I said earlier, that the priority of rural development, the priority of accelerating the pace of land redistribution is recognized in our discussion with other departments, and certainly in the Minister of Finance's discussions with his colleagues on the Minister's Committee and in Cabinet.
Thank you.
I confirm that. I don't even have to add anything. Thank you.
Well, Honourable Member, the difficulty faced by our department, if you compare what the state regards as five priorities of the nation, rural development, as far as we are concerned, is not really a priority. If you look at the framework you were quoting, we have noted that the department has been given 293 million rand as compared to large contributions made by that cabinet to various other priorities. We're not sure whether that is because the department is still at infancy of being recreated, or whether it is because the priority is less considered to be a priority in the eyes of that particular cabinet. Even if that is the case, even if it is because the department's capacity is under construction, we don't believe 293 million rand is adequate to address a priority, given the fact that via rural development and land reform in particular, you can address jobs, you can address the poverty in the rural areas, you can address rural livelihoods, so that we have an impact on the distortion of the economy as it stands now. We would not understand the motivation behind that cabinet decision to fund rural development in this particular manner. Given that fact, this committee then would not be enthusiastic to pursue ourselves as a priority. will regard ourselves as going through the mill of Parliament. And if that is the case, we resign to the fact that we will not make the impact that we're talking about in rural development. We sympathize with the minister. We cannot demand of him to produce results that are not up beyond his scope in terms of the available resources. But we do not believe that this department is regarded as a priority in that context. And we can be quoted as saying that, because in our view, the minister can only do the pilots with that amount of money. He will not make a bigger impact in the rural areas. Consider the fact that the traditional leaders are actually saying their land is lying fallow, because the majority of the men in the rural areas are out as migrant laborers in the urban areas. If they have to invite them both back to the land, what would they do there if there are no means with which to farm and do the land and cultivate the land? And that is why perhaps pressure is the wrong place to place our concern, but perhaps Treasurer must be aware that this is our view as the committee. And perhaps if our attempt is to assist the department, we should do so via Parliament rather than via Treasurer. Can we move on to our minister wants to make a comment? Okay.
Chair, I must declare my interest and say that I'm one of those culprits who make those decisions about the allocation of budget. Serving on the Milcom part. I think, Chair, that your concerns are valid, and I think this is a matter which has been expressed by the Milcom part for the five affected areas for priority for government. What we are trying to do, and this matter has been really been discussed, and I'm sure at some point it will come out from government. What we are trying to do, we're looking at how we can make the necessary impact on the five areas, and we looked at trying to synergize these areas in terms of budget allocation, to look at what is it that we can do as programs of government that will have effect on all five of them, full impact on all five of them. The second thing, so we're working on that, and I'm sure it's part of main combat, is part of what will probably submit to cabinet for cabinet to finalize this budget in a manner that will be informed by the challenges as well as the opportunities that are there. The second thing is that with regards to the department itself, because we are integrating the work of the commission and the redistribution, and we have agreed, and Treasury has been approached, and we're thankful for this, that we have agreed that we take 25% of the budget for land redistribution. In other words, so that we can, that's the point that Bishop was raising as well. So that what we will do is when we restitute or when we buy a farm, we know that 25% is done, is going to be for development. Now that way we're trying to augment the little money that we have by integrating all that we have, whether it's restitution or purchasing them through the land redistribution program. So it therefore means that the 260 or whatever figure you are calling, 200. Well, that figure would then combined would give us a bit of muscle to add to what has been passed through the adjustment operation. The effect of that in relation to the piloting is that we won't really focus that money on pilots. We'll spread it out. In fact, this is the money we hope we will use to add to replicate the pilot
we think that we will make some impact through that integrated approach. And finally, Chair, the other thing, the strength of this approach is that we also working very closely with other departments and municipalities. I hope that the model that is developing in Mpumalanga of meeting of matching rent for rent, it could just be done by other provinces as well, because in Mpumalanga they said if you say you've got 30 million rents like we do now, they say we put up another 30 million rents. As a result, in Mpumalanga we're not for confining to one place. We're working on three. We started straight away with three wards immediately. So it will just grow that way. So I'm saying, Chair, that thanks very much for the support. We appreciate it. The constraints are enormous. Thank you, Chair.
Maybe the better thing to do in agreement, therefore, with this approach is to allow this debate to stand over for when we are considering the strategy plan, rather than confine our debate here on the past. Remember, we're debating the annual report. This part that the minister is talking about will come into the strategic plan. So the matter must be put to rest as far as the annual report is concerned, and wait for the strategic plan to be tabled, and then we'll engage with that particular process as the minister is outlining. Honourable Mem.
Yes, Chair, I just think there's one aspect that we have to discuss, and it's really a concern to me, and this is with the court orders, and the minister did also answer to us in last week in Parliament. My biggest concern is that there's several of these court orders, and there's weekly orders against this department as we speak. I also know that the department is for contempt of court, held in contempt of court. As I understand it, it's that because they can't pay. One of the things that I heard is one of the commissioners will be taken to jail if the department doesn't pay. And I think it's very serious. We have to discuss this in this department. I did speak to some of the lawyers. The lawyers did ask me the details of the minister. They want to make an appointment with the minister. I think no one wants to take the department and put all the land claims commissioners in court. I just want to say that we need to discuss it. I don't know if the minister received any invitations and if they are meeting with the lawyers to try and solve this and to come up with a plan.
I know Honourable Delis did give us the letters of lawyers, and that those letters were passed on to the minister. But I don't think Honourable Stein today is the platform for us to debate that. Perhaps we would allow the minister at a relevant time to come back to us. I think suffice to say, Treasury should note that whatever you have allocated to the department, unforeseen and unavoidable costs will accrue from this court order, and perhaps brace yourself for an additional amount that will regard this matter. But please, can we not move on to the next item? I'm worried about the time as well. CG?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. The next item relates to the statement. The report, there is this report that has been circulated to you. The report with the title Response to Questions Raised by Portfolio Committee on Rural Development and Land Reform. Mm. The report there on item number two is responding to the issues of the state land. we are just saying that the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform is the custodian of the largest property portfolio in comparison to other government departments, and the next one is Public Works. And we have got all these properties which we have looked at. We've got a task team that is working with the Department of Public Works, because Public Works has also got a long list of properties. That members of the task team, in fact, they are meeting today, and they are meeting the Portfolio Committee on Public Works this afternoon to table their progress on this, where they have visited all provinces to look at the state lands, the lists that are there. Department of Public Works has the list, and we have the list of all the state lands that we have done the audit on. The challenges that they are raising on this list. Firstly, let me say that they have established that with the list of state land, it is reflected as owned by national departments, by provincial departments, and by municipalities. So these lists have got those lists that are there. But the challenge that is coming up is that there is a lot of land which is unsurveyed, especially in the ex-homeland areas. That land is unsurveyed, and secondly, that land is not vested. Vesting means you say which is the user department that is responsible for that land. Is it the Department of Education? Is it the Department of Health? Is it the Department of Defense? Is it the province? Is it the municipality? So vesting has to be done, but before you can do the vesting properly, you need the survey of the land to say what is the land parcels that you are vesting. So that is the challenge that we are having, that even though we may have the list of these properties, a lot of them have not been surveyed and therefore may not be vested, and the vesting has not happened. We are frustrating the vesting on all the land that has been surveyed, but we are working on that land which is not surveyed. We are working with the Department of Public Works to look at the program and the plan of surveying that land so that we can fast-track the surveying, which will help us to fast-track the vesting of the land. So that is the essence of this report. I will not go to the details where we have indicated what is in Kwaka, what is in Kazankulu, what is in Kwangwane, what is in Lebowa, what is Bandebele, those are homeland areas where they've got list of properties under each one. And these provinces may not have all the details, so that's what the committee reported to me yesterday. The two departments had a meeting yesterday to reflect on this, and they reported to me yesterday that the challenge is that the different provinces have different capacities to deal with this challenge, because those properties are sitting. Sometimes they were handed over to the premiers of these different provinces, and they are working with the various provinces on this matter. So the long shot of this report is that we are working on this, and we are going to come up with a vesting plan and with the survey plan for these properties. That is what we are working on. I think that's the report, Chairperson. On the
right. Is the report, honourable member? Honourable Swati.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I've got only one question to ask the DG with regard to the answer statement. I just want to find out as to whether they budget. Do they have the budget to do that, so that when they come, when they want to do that, next time when they come to report back to us, they can also give us the results. Thank you.
Did you, when we received the report from the Ingwanyama Trust, they indicated that they've done all the former KwaZulu area, and they are only left with 300 titles that are held by the state. The only little thing that I would want to understand, I read in your document that you're putting this word out to tender. Has the Ingonyama Trust done this thing itself, or did they put it out to tender? And who do you have the capacity and the means to verify whether those people who have been asked to do this work on behalf of the department are accurate and reflective of the real situation? You remember you were saying to us, part of what the Surveyor General is trying to find out is who, in whose hands the land is. Part of it is registered as state, but it's on third party's hands. So given that experience, we would be worried that if the work is given out to tender, whether that would not reflect a possible conflict. Honorable Danda.
Yes, mine is just a question for clarification.
Honorable Chair, I need to understand, when you say that areas are being surveyed in the former homeland, are you actually just referring to the parts that were counted, or are you actually meaning everything, including rural communities, completely?
There's no other hand, so go ahead.
Yeah, I will ask Mungu to respond to some of the questions, because he has been working very closely with this with this process. But I can indicate that on the issue of the survey plans and the vetting plans, we do not need external capacity. That part can be done internally. We do have the Office of the Surveyor General. They are able to do this. But on the actual work of doing the survey, the production of the survey diagrams, that work may be quite detailed, so we may need the support. That is the part that we could put to tender. But even if they do that, they would be working on a very clear plan, which would have been developed by us as the department. Mdu, can you respond to the rest of the question?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Just to come to your question, whether Ingonyama Trust did this work on its own, let me start by saying that the bulk of the surveying of the former KwaZulu territory was done by the former KwaZulu government itself. So approximately 95% of that was done by the former KwaZulu government. Hence, there were title deeds available at the time of the establishment of the trust. What the Ingonyama Trust did, obviously outsourcing the work to professional surveyors, was to consolidate the title deeds and the different properties into a consolidated asset register or cadastre. The question asked by Honorable Tandala, the extent of the survey, yes, we were surveying everything. But mainly focusing on the outside physical boundaries of communities, of towns, and everything else, so that in the end you can account for all that belongs to the state. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Shabana, you did indicate in the previous presentation of the same answer that the Surveyor General is auditing the total surface of South Africa, including privately owned land, but also then registering the separate state register. Is that still the answer now?
May the Honorable Chair just repeat the question so that I'm clear that I'm answering the right question.
Well, we gained an impression that the Surveyor General surveys the total surface of South Africa, but then registering the land that belongs to the state, separate from those that belong to individual or entities.
Honorable Chair, they have that function for approval of all surveyed land in the country, public or private. what we're doing in terms of the plan that the DG presented. We are focusing on that which belongs to the state, because that is where there is uncertainty, that is where there remains land that is unsurveyed. So the involvement of the Surveyor General in this specific instance is to complete and provide oversight over the over the completion of surveying of unsurveyed state land.
Follow-up question, Honourable Shaban, is the Auditor General came to us and told us, Honourable Minister, that your department, in their view, perhaps we don't know as a committee, but in their view, it is your responsibility to survey the total surface of South Africa. It is no other department. And given that, what are you actually contending as unsurveyed land? Is only the former homeland land or the rest of the land, including those that pieces of land that used to be called the Republic of South Africa?
Chair, the Office of the Chief Surveyor General, by law, has the mandate of overseeing and certifying accuracy of extent of land in South Africa. That is why private persons in the country would buy a farm, subdivide it, frame new diagrams. It is the Office of the Surveyor General, and only the Office of the Surveyor General, that has got that mandate in South Africa, irrespective of who the owner is. If you want to change ownership, the size of land, you frame diagrams, it is the Surveyor General that approves the extent of land in South Africa, and therefore would then pass that on to the Chief Register of Deeds, who will give you a title deed on the basis of the survey that has been authorized or verified by the Chief Surveyor General.
Honourable Dandara.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm still wanting to pursue my question a little further then. If what is being surveyed are the outer boundaries, I would like to know who, and we also hear that even the other surveying that should be done internally at the end of the day is the responsibility of the Surveyor General. What are the plans of surveying inside what has been surveyed outside?
The question is clear to me. I don't know. Honorable Shaban?
Okay. When you look at state land in general, in South Africa, it will always comprise of land as the property of the state, but in various parts of the country, in the former homeland, you will find a lot of other state domestic assets. That will include your schools, your clinics, police stations, and so on. Now, we are saying in this exercise of conducting this, or of completing the survey, as we survey the outer boundaries, the responsible state department must take the responsibility, because they also have a duty to have complete asset register. In other words, if there are schools in the former Transkei, former KwaZulu, those schools are the properties that must be transferred to the relevant state department. So the surveying of the schools to excise them from the portfolio that belongs to the Department of Land Affairs, of Rural Development and Land Reform, is the function of the custodian department. So our department will not be bearing the cost of surveying out those properties on behalf of other custodian departments. Then you would find within that, the former homeland, there will be several townships. In the case of KwaZulu-Natal with the Ngonyama Trust Act, the Act provides specifically that the townships must be excised and transferred to the local municipalities in whose jurisdiction they fall. I would imagine that would be the case in respect of any other township within your former homeland. The whole question of completing their the town township plans and the registration thereof, then it is a function that moves away from the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform and becomes the responsibility of that relevant municipality in respect of township. That would be the same thing with dams and so on and so on.
My little knowledge of what you're talking about will also give rise to the question. In most of these entities you're talking about would have something like the establishment of a township when they were established originally. And therefore there would be an advanced plan that is already there, which the relevant department or local authority would have when that township was established. And the record, therefore, would not necessarily be accruing an additional amount of money, because it would have been undertaken at that particular point, not unless in the homeland, the rules did not apply in the same way as the urban area. But it is relevant for me to understand whether, when you establish a township, and the establishment of all townships are registered by the relevant authority under whose jurisdiction that township is established, and when the title deeds of in the former townships, you have a 99-year lease on a piece of land that belongs to the urban Bantu Council. You remember that. But the establishment of the township itself would have been registered under the jurisdiction of that authority. Don't you have that report? Why would you incur an additional cost if that has to be consolidated?
Chairperson, there are formal and informal townships in South Africa. Many of the informal ones you would find in the rural areas. There would be rudimentary township establishment plans. In some instances where you've got these townships, those plans that were put in place, but you would find that the form of tenure for people living in those townships was not a freehold. They were quit rents, they were deeds of grants, and so on and so on. So to take that process the next step, you'll have, in the case of informal townships, because there was specific legislation that provided for establishment of informal townships. So they will be formal and informal. So in the case of informal, you've got to formalize it to move from informal to formal. We have got a particular role, however, in this particular department, because we administer tenure legislation. And therefore, municipalities and departments of local government naturally will come to our department to say, you administer this legislation. In many instances, however, in some provinces, they will come to us and say, we have got the money, we want to partner with you to use your legislation to upgrade title and register a formal township in many of your rural areas, particularly on state land. That is where that interface between our department and the municipalities happen. That is the extent to which would incur cost.
Recouped from the relevant department.
Where we have got the responsibility to complete our asset register, we will have to incur the cost. But any further work to do inside boundaries and all that, and that becomes the work of that particular authority, be it a local municipality or a local government arm of that particular province. Where it relates to us having to complete our own asset register, we generally incur those costs. When it comes to the land that falls under the department, we don't do it. We don't pay for every department. Each department pays for its own work, for its own assets.
If you look at on a first page, 2.1.3, it says that it was estimated in 1994 that government, national and provincial spheres, had about 24 million hectares, and 13.5 million of which is under the custody of the then Department of Land Affairs. This figure excluded unsurveyed land, particularly in the former homeland. My question is, 15 years after 1994, do we not have an accurate record and audit of what is owned by who and what belongs to the state? From what I'm reading here, we are still in the process, because 2.1.7 says that surveying project plans are currently being formulated per province and will be completed in 2009. Are we really saying that as a state, as a government, we don't know what we own, what is state-owned land? Especially in view of the fact what the DG said earlier on, that there is about 3 million hectares state-owned land, and out of that, they have distributed about 1.5 million hectares. So it's all estimates, but it's not factual. When will we ever have completely audited report of what is owned by us? And I say by us because all state-owned land belongs to all of us.
Oh, no, but the real reason why we are pursuing this particular topic today was because we made that discovery during that process where they were answering this particular question. Mm-hmm. And we are now clearer that the work is not complete. Mm-hmm. You remember we had a meeting with the Auditor General who informed us about this particular fact. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why their report has been qualified. It was qualified precisely because of this particular point. Mm. So to pursue this particular question beyond this point, I don't think it will serve any particular purpose. Mm. Perhaps what we need to do, put this particular question, Honorable Dilim, to the process of the strategic plan, so that what the DG is saying here in this document will be part of the strategic plan, or those tasks that will be part of the strategic plan. Mm. Thank you very much. Let's move on to the next item.
Thank you very much. I think I'll ask him to speak to this item because he has actually spoken to it, but I would like him to maybe underline some of the important issues. This is the issue of the Ingwanyama Trust Board land, about those 300 properties that we talked about.
Honorable Chair.
Ukuba is an outstanding matter, what we have to agree on now is to factor it in the strategic plan.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah. Chair, I'm saying there is work in progress in this regard. It is not complete. We can obviously provide in the strategic plan should the current challenges not be resolved before the end of March. If we have to take them through the next financial year, we will. But they're not that complex.
See, the advantage here is that the 300 pieces of land, there's good of wheat domestic, what are the domestic what?
Yeah, the
social assets,
yeah,
which are already known to the Ingwanyama Trust. All you have to do is to use that title deed to transfer them to the relevant department.
Yes.
Thank you, Mdu. Can we move on to the other question?
Yeah, the last question that we were responding to was the details about the communal property associations. How many, where are they, and what are the type of the issues that relate to the CPAs and their land holding?
Can I explain why we ask the question? Honorable Minister, the law requires that the DG reports to you on an annual basis, not only about the existence of a CPA, but the state of each, and the land parcel that that CPA holds, and the condition of that land, whether it's being productive or not. And in turn, the minister reports to Parliament. And we ask this question because none of the reports we have received up to this point contained any report of that particular nature. And that is why we ask the question. So, the list is called, he comply with the requirements of the law. Because the list itself does not tell us about the state of each CPA, the audit that you have conducted of the performance of that CPA, and whether the land they hold is productive or not. It's a list. So we will require that report, which Parliament requires of the minister, to be produced in this regard.
I'm very happy with the point you're making, because the CPAs because the CPAs I've asked the DG and the DDG to provide this report, not only because of the requirement of the law, but as I'm learning that there are legal obligations which need to be fulfilled in the department. But I'm prompted also by the challenges that relate to the CPAs. One of the biggest challenges that I've come across is that CPAs, this is what I learned particularly from traditionalists, they put it this way: CPAs are daylight robbery. That's what they tell me. As a result, I've developed a concept around it. So part of what I've asked the DG to do is to give me the full report so that I can report to Parliament, surely via Cabinet, and then express those views. I asked the DG to raise this matter at the weekend when he addressed on my behalf. I wanted to be myself, to be there myself in KwaZulu-Natal, Kondolese. Because this is a very, very important, it has become a very, very important matter. Conflicts are beginning to emerge. KwaZulu-Natal, Eastern Cape, Limpopo, Northwest. Because the traditional leaders say they want the island back, and land is in terms of the law restituted to ordinary South Africa. They say the land belongs to us in this place. So it is a major, major problem. And I'm sure the committee will assist us when we come back with this meeting. We will certainly come back with a very strong proposal. So thank you, Chair. I appreciate really your comment in this meeting and in the committee. Thank you.
Yeah, Chairperson, I'm busy assisting the community in establishing a CPA now, and I've looked at the Act, and the Act of 1996, and even I think for us as a committee, we need to review that. The process is cumbersome. There's not enough described in the Act of actual community involvement. There's, for instance, a constitution. That they must first adopt, and the community must all agree about the contents of the constitution. Then they have to conduct elections in terms of that constitution. And what I was also concerned about in the Arrest legislation is that at what point do you establish the CPA? In this case, where I'm involved with now and assisting the community, there's already been a settlement and a payment made. It's a finalized claim, and the CPA is only going to be established now. Now, they have worked with a committee, which is sort of an interim committee, and the people say, but what is the CPA about? They only hear about it now. So I would also suggest to the committee chairperson that we look at that legislation to maybe make it a bit more simpler. Thank you.
Yes, Chair, I want to agree with Honourable Dino. When we visited some of the areas, that's the main thing, that people felt that they were the group of people who laid the claim, or not laid the claim, claimed the land, and now they're not part of it. So I think there's huge confusion around this CPA and what it's supposed to do, and I agree, and I think I would appreciate if the minister come up. I don't know if we need to be part of any think tank at this stage. But I also want to know if there's any link with the CPA and this CLARA, which I still don't understand. I don't know if we can tackle it together or two separate issues, but I think the laws that we have is really binding our hands in moving forward with land reform.
A bit of your comment is in the form of a question. Maybe we will allow the teacher to respond. But Honourable Minister, the CPAs are not confined to Bantustan. There are many CPAs that are peri-urban or outside the Bantustans, but in the rural areas of the former republic. And some CPAs are working fine, some CPAs are daylight robbery, as you say. I remember there was a CPA next to, between PE and Udnake, that owns that big township that is being developed there, and there's a lot of land that is undeveloped. You know the history of that CPA. There's been fights all along, and politics have been playing a leading role, but politics is just used as an excuse to gain the biggest influential position in the CPA in order to control the resources there. So for us, it is a very curious area that we are exposed to in this committee regarding the CPAs. And unfortunately, people die in CPAs, other people resign and leave, other people leave without resigning, and the CPA is usually left in the hands of a few. Sometimes those are strong-armed, muscled people who take over from the rest of the members. There are CPAs that are truly honest and doing their work properly, but we want a total picture. We want the information that will empower us to be able to pursue this matter. Can we give you the last bit of Honourable Stein's question?
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair. I've noted these comments. They are very useful. In fact, they will assist us in the review of the CPA. And I think in that review, we can also put Clara as part of that process to look at what works under what circumstances, and going forward, what would be the best way to deal with all of this. On our side, we would appreciate your support on the review of the policy as well as the review of the legislation that will inform that. I must say that we believe that our review process is going to affect quite a number of the areas that you have raised here at the committee. That would be my concluding remark. I note the issues, mainly governance, the issues of resource control from land to the benefits that come from that land allocation for those people, and the issue that relates to the power plays that are happening in the CPAs. Those matters will be very critical in this review process. I thank you, Chair.
The last one is the 200 struggling issues.
I think Commissioner Zombie is there.
Yes,
the finalization of the outstanding restitution claims, as well as the struggling 200 projects.
That's why we need team for me, Lord.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. We have a presentation here. It's been distributed, titled Presentation to the Portfolio Committee. We had thought that we would project it on the screen, but we are told we don't have an overhead projector. Just the on page 2 quickly. The page 2 of the presentation. Page 2 of the presentation deals with the content. We will be looking at the findings of the survey of 200 struggling projects and strategies to recapitalize projects, challenges with strategic partnerships and joint ventures. And then we were also asked to report on the cabinet decision on Kruger National Park, and finally the analysis of our outstanding claims. Page 3 of the presentation, in early 2008, in line with the then Land and Agrarian Reform Program LARP, the Commission submitted a list of restitution projects that were approved for restoration to the department, to the then Department of Agriculture, before it became Agriculture, Forestry, and Fisheries. The projects are listed per province, and in total there are 224. On page 4, they cover the following, or they could be broadly categorized in terms of the following areas: livestock, cattle, dairy, game, poultry. This is about 131 projects. Crops, sugarcane, maize, cash crops, and others, 127 projects. Others include tourism and conservation. The support required for these projects straddles across a broad area, from handling, dipping, holding facilities for cattle, purchasing of livestock, game reserve, game and cattle, infrastructure development, water, purchasing of breeding stock, implementation of the business plans, which were developed by, by departments of provincial departments of agriculture, in some instances service providers, operational costs, that input costs, movable assets, and resources to start cash crop enterprises, agricultural expertise and technical support, which is needed on some of these projects, re-establishment of sugarcane crops and citrus, this would be the case in KZN, Mpumalanga, and Limpopo, and also firefighting equipment, because in most instances, in the case of disasters, there's no plan facilities to manage the occurrence of fires and other sort of natural disasters. Page 5, we have summarized the challenges, which are mainly due to lapsing time before new landowners take over as a result of delays in transfer, which then results in rundown farms. Once a claim is settled, the transfer process takes time in certain instances, and this results in huge problems because of caretakership arrangement. Claimants are not ready to occupy the farm at that stage, so that has been a problem, and this, the farm ends up in, you know, run down or vandalized for various purposes, infrastructure or even houses, sheds and other facilities, equipment on farms. Grants not calculated in terms of business enterprise. The grant system is not helpful because it's only 25% of the total value of the land. In some of the projects, it is sufficient, in others it is not sufficient. It's based, it's not really based on the nature of the business. It's just grants across the board, and it might fall far too short of what is required to assist beneficiaries with production and other you know, requirements. Lack of infrastructure to maintain the enterprise. The infrastructure, most of the time, even when production happens, you find that infrastructure on farms is not sufficient to maintain viable, you know, production and sustainable enterprise on farms. Insufficient resources to purchase livestock to start the enterprise, where, you know, the economic activities, livestock farming, certain instances, the resources available, as I said, are not sufficient. In other instances, they also want to, you know, start economic ventures, not necessarily farming, because there are instances where the size of the land is not just viable for the initiation of, this, of farming activities. So they want to start other economic development projects on the land, and they don't just have access to capital to do that. Resources needed to build capacity in the community to ensure sustainable management, development of enterprise, technical enterprise, management and skills. There isn't dedicated capacity to do this. There wasn't in the past, and hopefully now with the new department this will be addressed. But then capacity building of communities takes long. On some of these enterprises, you really need to put people through formal training to understand the nature of the enterprise and to be able to run it, such as in forestry and some of the very high commercial enterprises. Institutional development capacity building also. This was, I think, the previous discussion. We start new institutions in CPAs. They are dealt with, I mean, we initiate them in terms of the law, technical processes. But there's absolutely no assistance thereafter. Follow up and actually assisting them in how to governance issues, how to run meetings, all of those things, how to deal with conflict. There's no such training given to this institution. So you need some capacity building program for this entity. the next page, which is slide 6, insufficient funds to acquire implements and equipment to maintain agricultural enterprise, tractors and graders. I know that in some of these projects in the past in Limpopo, the former MEC, who's now Minister for Health, provided over 20 tractors to these communities. Now all of those tractors are dysfunctional. They have been stripped off. He did what he could to assist, and in most none of those tractors are functional now. In instances where these equipment are acquired at a huge cost, there's also the problem with their running, their control, and also a question relating to abuse, because CPA's rules are quite loose, and there's no real enforcement once people don't comply with the rules in the CPA, because they can do what they like and they cannot be, you know, jailed or, you know, penalized, or, because it's just social. The consensus things, you don't, that's why disagreements are so huge. Lack of medium term operational costs to maintain current enterprise. I don't think in most of these enterprises, the long term view is not taken. For example, to implement some of these business plans would take a period of 5 years or even more in the case of forestry. But then it's always the short term view. And then I think implementing a business plan, you need a long term view. We need to also understand that it might take 3 to 4 years before you, you know, attain economies of scale and you cover all the costs, just like any other business. So that's the problem that we are faced with. It's always short-term views, and the CPAs and the community is not trained to understand that this, like any other business, has its own risk which needs to be managed in the long term. Challenges in terms of business planning. Some of the business planning, that business plans that we receive from provincial departments of agriculture, which we have used, are not worth the paper they are written on. And even from service providers, they are not really worth the paper they are written on. Once you implement them, you find that there's such huge discrepancies. They are technical, they are not understood by the community, they are understood by the author, and some of them are actually desktop business plans which can be drawn from a website, and which do not really relate to the reality of what's going on the ground. The 7 revive processes, slide number 7, on the strategies to deal with this. We have pointed out before, Honorable Chair, that the Commission, really, given the technical nature and the scope, the vast scope of some of these projects, would not have the skills within it to deal with these challenges, because some of them really require technical, very highly technical skills, which in certain cases even provincial departments of agriculture were not able to offer, as was earlier indicated. Finalize the establishment of post-settlement unit within the department. This has been, I think, done. The post-settlement unit is now under a new branch in the department. Address budgetary constraints within the economic cluster. So I think we also need to deal with the treasury regulations. So the position of treasury was that once the fund is spent, you cannot allocate more resources to this project, because that would represent, constitute double dipping. But I think if we take a development perspective, you would find that even in normal business, you would find that the failure rate is put at about 30 or 40% failure rate of all businesses that start in the first or second year. But once people learn the lessons and they are given proper support, then they are able to succeed. But and I think it applies to any business. And I think the judgment in the case of land reform beneficiaries has been a bit harsh, in the sense that once they try, to implement the projects and they do not succeed, then we actually apply technical sort of argument insofar as resourcing and recapitalization is concerned. Additional resource, but we must also hasten to mention, Chair, that not every project in restitution serves an economic purpose, because where particularly you have huge communities on small portions of land, it's economically, some of the projects, from a pure economic point of view, if you assess them, they may not be viable, given the numbers and given the nature of the land, productive capacity of the land. Some of those things have not been mentioned. It is only in quite few instances where you would have commercially viable enterprises that we could actually talk to. Others really serve a social purpose, serve other purposes other than, economic ones. Additional resource mobilization. We thought that as part of the solution, where you have economically viable projects, you could obtain assistance from companies and institutions which are willing to assist. But there's also a rationale why companies want to get involved. They just want they don't want to get involved because it's a social responsibility or something like that. They want to involve because there's business sense in some of this. So if there's no business sense, they won't get involved, including perhaps status, even including some of the farmers. The challenges is strategic partnerships and joint ventures. One of the challenges facing us is to restore highly commercial properties, and we have said this already, and this would be sugarcane and mangoes and export produce and all of this. The properties are usually characterized by extensive agricultural estates which mainly export their produce to overseas countries. It is therefore incumbent upon the Commission to put in place measures that will ensure continued operation of these high-value agricultural estates after restoration to claimant communities. But I also must hasten to mention that once we have transferred the land and the communities are assisted in getting strategic partners, they form joint ventures and operating companies, which are effectively, in terms also of the law, in control of processes of the land and so on. So as far as government is concerned, and I think we have a few cases, they will tell us in some instances where we even attempt to assist that we have no business interfering, because now this is their land, they own it, and what do we want from them? And they will do. Some of them have failed to take our advice on a number of issues, and I think we have got a number of examples. Because suddenly, what you then have in this project is that the commercial enterprise, you need to maintain the confidence of the market, the suppliers, quality control issues, and once the former owner is gone, the clients or the customers or the markets are no longer really interested, and so they'll probably not have the same confidence as they had with the previous owner. And you need to actually assist them with the marketing and to ensure that some of what they produce is actually marketed overseas. In one of the projects, Mama Thola in Limpopo, immediately after transfer, we had a situation, I think, about 4 or 5 years ago, where even mangoes got rotten on the ground. Most half of the produce was lost because then they had nobody to market it. So some of those things were not actually dealt with when we transferred the land to and it applies to a few other projects also. One of the measures that the CS Commission came up with is the strategic partnership model, whereby joint ventures between claimants and established commercial farmers are entered to over longer periods. This process has unintended consequences with the South African farm management. I think it was also done through the Limpopo Department of Agriculture and Mpumalanga, where the strategic partner actually exposed the community to huge risk by borrowing. But although they would say this was discussed with the joint venture, with the trustees, in the end, I think we found that projects were placed in a situation where they had to be liquidated because of they were not able to cover costs. It was an economic issue of how they were managed and also the accounting side of things. And these are very complex because the communities really, given the profile of the community, most of them would not even be business people. Even if you found teachers or lawyers, but they don't understand finance and accounting in the same community. So they can't read balance sheets, they can't read the books, and whatever they are presented with, they tend to agree. And what normally gets declared is a loss, but the sales are not declared. Different operating companies are formed, marketing companies are formed which are not declared, and whatever happens, the change of money, how it moves from one company to the other, they are not able to pick it up simply because they don't understand finances. And this is some of the problems with the strategic partnerships, such as we had the SAF and farm management. But also the accounting side of things, where they were not able to account to what the grants that were transferred to them, they were not able to account how grants were used. Their own equity, how much they paid in terms of equity, were not able to account. And sales, volumes of sales, they were not able to actually account for that. And actually the profit and net profit after payment of all the costs, they were not able to account for that. So this is the problem with some of the strategic partnerships that we have. But again, just to say, the problem with the strategic is an unequal relationship, because you've got somebody who's run the business for years and the community has not even run a tuck shop at the corner, street corner. So you have a situation where they can easily be ripped off without understanding the dynamics of the business itself. The other thing was particularly with agriculture, because such a difficult enterprise, and given its variety, and also given the volatility of the markets in agriculture, they don't even understand that if you plant vegetable farming is highly risky because of the markets and the fluctuating prices. You can actually get the whole fields green, but it doesn't guarantee your profits and all of that. So they don't understand that. They just go into it because they believe somehow that that's the way to go, and they are advised to go that direction. So you really need technical information and technical knowledge of the area, which they do not have. The DAF and Regional Land Claims Commissioners depend on strategic partners to ensure effective operations. May I just also mention that also in citrus, as is was the case in Limpopo, Bidiela, and I think an area called Limbe. Bidiela was once a huge citrus exporting state farm, but now I think it's operating at just about half its potential, or less than half of its potential. And those are some of the problems. And the strategic partner actually was also employed through the Department of Agriculture. They are not able to really bring it to. In most instances, they also require state funding. And our argument has been, if this is a viable business, why does it require state funding? Because you can go to any commercial bank and get the funding and be able to cover your costs and be able to. It doesn't really require state funding if it is a viable commercial enterprise. So they haven't really given us good answers on that. We say they are more development profit-oriented than development-oriented. No social development plan for communities. We talked about misuse of funds as received as dividends and lack of development impact. What is worse about them is that they end up benefiting only a few members of the trust and the CTAs. And the communities, the rest of the community do not benefit from these operations in most instances. There's no real benefit flow to communities. That's why they lose morale, they are demoralized, because over a long period, they see CPAs, trustees, and chairpersons with their cell phones and driving good cars, and no report back to communities. In terms of the CPA Act, obviously, they should have annual report backs. On finances and on the activities and on all sorts of issues, reports should be given. But in most instances, this would not be happening. It becomes a deal between the strategic partner and a few members of the committee in the trust. So this is what's happening in most of this project. We are saying also, when there's no proper model of choosing the strategic partner, most partners are previous owners of the same farm. That's on page 11. Some sold their farms because they had inadequate financial support. Some sold their farms because they did not have, they were on the brink of bankruptcy and they were about to be liquidated. And that was the reason why they actually wanted to get into strategic partnerships. There's a whole range of reasons why they want to get into strategic partnerships. And obviously, they would not declare some of these issues, and they would not be open about them. Operating companies are being formed by the strategic partners and communal property associations. The board members in this new company are both members of the CPA and the strategic partners, which affect accountability. We are saying a CPA member should not also be directors of the newly formed company. Because CPA members, the role of the CPA is governance. It's about ensuring good administration, resolving issues of policy setting. So if you have a situation where members are also directors on the board, there's a clear conflict of interest. And you see, they are both referee and player, and it's not good. So the separation needs to happen. No formula to determine the list of the property to the operating company, and properties are listed over long periods without the stipulation of maintenance or production standards on the list line. nor formulated exit strategy and discussion the sustainability of the project. The strategic partner normally exits when they sense trouble, that now the business is in deep trouble, and then that's when they would actually demand more funding from government. And if funding doesn't come, they threaten to exit. I think in some of the projects, they have requested funding 2 or 3 times, and that's part of the problem that we have. And there's no formula of determining the contribution or equity of both parties. In most instances, I think they rely on development grants from claimants. Their own contribution is not visible. They will normally say they contribute expertise, but some of them, even their expertise is very suspect because they have not proven track record as individual farmers. So they have no expertise to talk of because on their own account, they have not demonstrated or proved themselves to be good farmers. Level of exposure of beneficiaries to the market, because I talked about that. Delays in the disbursement of grants, delays the business plans. The problem, maybe this is just one of the last problems, the grant system is such that you can take a position where you give the community grants to develop its own business plans. It doesn't help. You first clearly need to assist them with the business planning process so that when you disperse grants, they can be used for the right purpose. But there's also conflict between that, because some communities need grants to be deposited directly so that they can take control of how these grants are used. Conflict between CPA versus partners, the community versus CPA, or intra-CPA conflict. Okay. So I think that would be on the strategic partnership. We're just saying from the analysis that we have done of all the CPA chairpersons, that would be, in summary, the challenges that we have come across. Maybe I should stop there so far as that is concerned. The recommendations, maybe we should come with a recommendation. In terms of recommendations, the Commission has identified and will propose interventions and strategies to the new branch, which should have the required capacity to address all these challenges. And I think the branch is in the process of developing that capacity in the department. We also think that with projects of an agricultural nature, the Department of Agriculture should really complement, particularly when it comes to agricultural engineers and specific skills required for, you know, production on some of these farms, which because if it is there in government, we don't need to go out there because it becomes expensive, very expensive to outsource, you know, those skills. From both project officials and CPA members by closely monitoring the operations of strategic partners and ensure their accountability. Closer project planning and monitoring and evaluation of the implementation must be done by the department, because I don't think that, as Chair correctly observed in the past meeting, the monitoring was I think we need to tighten the monitoring. A crucial element is skills development programs and training for new landowners, as well as effective empowerment models for community control and ownership. And I think we do not have the real empowerment models for community control and ownership. So I think those would be the recommendations. Thanks, Chair.
Yes, when you bring this report here to the committee, are they a product of the departmental internal debate, or is just sections submitting their own responses to you for you to bring them here.
I think the summaries were this is the result of an analysis of the projects by the department.
So it's what we regard this report as a report of the department?
Yes.
By department, are you referring to DG supervising the submission of this report to RPA?
Yes, there was a review, actually there was a review which included this project by the department, a review of about over 300 projects, I think, about 2 years ago. So this was taken from that review. Commissioned by the department.
Yes. Can we take that this report therefore is the... The department report.
Yes.
And everything said in this report reflects the opinion of the department.
Yes.
Can you do that under oath?
Yes, yes.
All of you are witnesses. Turn to page 16 of the whole report.
16.
Page 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15.
15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15.
15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. Whether the purpose of the department is said in charge of these witnesses, yes. I ask you whether there is all these opinions here are the opinions of the department is said, yes. Now, what do you to tell us whether the department feels that the cabinet decision must be subjected to the court? Is that what you're saying?
I presented on the project, Chair. This is Kruger National Park. I have not presented on the Kruger National Park. This relates to the Kruger National Park, and there's a context for that. I'll still come to the project Kruger National Park.
Can you tell me who's reporting this one? The Kruger National Park. Is it the department or what?
Well, the Kruger National Park, there is a process that was set up.
Commissioner, is this report the departmental report, or is it your report?
The commission is part of the department, so...
Answer my question. Is this report the departmental report, or yours?
This report is drafted by the commission.
Who's the owner of this report? Remember, this is the portfolio committee of parliament.
Yes.
And we have asked the department to come and make a presentation. You have given us this report. I want you on page 15, tell us that bit is not belonging to the department. It's not the ownership of the department. That's why I asked you to say it under oath.
On page 15, as I said, this was drafted by the commission. Can I explain the context, Chair?
The ownership. I'm not looking for the context.
The ownership is a commission report. On Kruger National Park.
It belongs to the department, therefore.
It's commission report on Kruger National Park.
It belongs to the department. Sure. I want you to read this part, which makes you unable to give me a clear answer. Read it yourself to the House. The third last bullet of page 15. Read it.
It says the cabinet decision needs to be tested in court. But
what do you mean by that?
But this was the community. This was the community.
What do you mean by that? This is a report given to us by the department.
The communities that were consulted said the cabinet decision needs to be tested in court.
This report does not come from the community. It comes from the department by the commission.
I'm asking whether that line represents the opinion of the department or not.
It doesn't represent
the report given to us by you.
It doesn't represent the opinion of the department. It represents the opinion of the community.
Why is it
important? Because it is important to hear what the communities are saying. That was the reason.
Should we accept it as a part of the report from the department or not?
Well, I wouldn't say you should accept it, Chair. If it's not acceptable, maybe we can take it out. But if it is acceptable, we thought it was necessary to reflect what the communities are saying, because our mandate was that they should be consulted, and then we should reflect on their, we should actually give feedback on their, on what their stance, their position in regard to cabinet decisions.
Which part of this report should be acceptable? Which one should not?
Well, I have not presented the report yet, so I wouldn't know. Because if I was given the opportunity to present the report, I would have done so. And maybe you would then pose the question.
I was reading this report as you were presenting it. You have skipped some lines, and you have read some of them, even in the one that you have already submitted. So I'm wondering whether there will be part of this report that we should accept, which part of it will not be acceptable. That's why I'm asking the question. I'm not pressing in one opinion only. I'm talking about the whole report.
It's my responsibility to
say what was said in this committee is acceptable or not.
No, but honestly, Chair, I can't be questioned on a report that's not been presented. If I present it and you give me the opportunity to present it, then you'll understand the context.
Go ahead, then. Present it.
The
tell us which parts will be acceptable, which parts will not be.
Well, challenges. Well, let's on the initial application. Yeah. Report starts on page 14. Report on Cabinet's decision regarding the Kruger National Park land claims. In 2008, Cabinet approved equitable redress, which is alternative land or financial compensation, as the only means to provide restitution in the Kruger National Park. Additional scoping is being done and further information to present the challenges in implementing the Cabinet's 2008 decision is being obtained and engagement with communities taking place. One of the main challenges also facing the Commission now is the unintended consequence that provincial parks are also now insisting on following this route of non-restoration. The reason being the what was obtained from Cabinet, the scene obtained from Cabinet applied only to the Kruger National Park and not to other conservation areas. But now the parks are also saying they would like to follow the same decision should apply to them in respect of other conservation areas. The claimants insist on restoration of land entitled to be involved in economic activities within the park. It is impossible to get alternative land as most of the land is under claim, and any private land is far removed from where the claimants are. I should just mention, Honorable Chair, that when we first the first information that we had was that there's about 400,000 hectares approximately under claim, but with scoping and mapping having been done, it's about 900,000 hectares. Non-restoration has a huge financial implication, and then we've also done basic computation of what it would cost. We only, I think Mpumalanga, the commissioner is here, acting commissioner. We almost, done with the scoping and mapping. We are still, left with the process still has to be finalized on the Limpopo side of the Kruger National Park. But the ballpark figure that we have now is about 21 billion that it would cost. There wouldn't be any land equal to about 900,000 hectares anyway in that area. So quite clearly the option of restoration or alternative land. It's almost a non-starter. If there's insistence on implementing the KNP decision, claimants may be disruptive and may vandalize the park, including illegal hunting. This is already happening in KZN, Smangaliso, Duma Game Reserve, where we've had to intervene. Claimants bringing down fences and also selling, attempting to destroy, the trees and all of that. So this is a very, very difficult issue. So the claimants have said to us, well, we've communicated to them and the residents, therefore, and they are insisting that they be given title to this land, and or else that the cabinet decision should be tested in court. That's what they are saying. Paying compensation may throw good money after bad practice. After the claimants have utilized the money, they may still insist on using and accessing what they perceive as their land, which has already happened in KZN. Claimants also require basin land. Park fence is close to the claimants, and risk of lions and foot and mouth disease is prevalent. This is just on page 60 when. Sorry. Just a minute. Why the commission? Sorry. Yeah, I think that's where it stops. But just to say, the process now, before the cabinet memo can be finalized, the process now awaits the completion of the mapping and the scoping exercise from Limpopo. Once Limpopo is through, we would know the options that are available. But as far as we are concerned, the only sustainable option in the Kruger National Park when the claimants are given title in land in the Kruger National Park. The debate chair ranged from proclaiming the park, which I don't think we should go that way. But I think because in 2002 a decision was taken that there would be co-management agreements in these areas by cabinet developed between Department of Environmental Affairs and then Department of Land Affairs. And now, since cabinet has, in a sense, come up with this decision, the only viable alternative, as I see it, would be to ensure that the land is restored in time and that there be, it be, the co-management agreement be implemented in the park, and this is really the only sort of sustainable option. Otherwise, the cost might be for 50. 21 billion is just indicative cost. It takes aggregate values of land, but doesn't really apply to specific areas in the park, which others could fetch much higher value, while others could fetch lesser value. So we are saying the cost might even be higher, because this is a conservative estimate until we have done all the necessary work that needs to be done. That I should stop there on the Kruger National Park.
Come back to my question. You finished your presentation.
Yes.
Can you answer my question now?
Yes.
You said I cannot question you on the report that
you have not tabled. Now you're tabled. Give me the answer.
I've tabled the report. I'm saying this is a feedback. The report that is drafted by the commission is a feedback to your committee.
Remember, we informed both the treasury, we informed the appropriation committee, we informed everybody here that we are meeting with the department to give us responses to the questions that we tabled to the department. Now, I want to know this part of the report. Who is the owner?
It was drafted by the commission.
Yes, ma'am.
Honorable Chair, I think it needs to, what the clarity that we can give is that this report belongs to the department, to a departmental report. Various sections of that department would make input on the functions or on the areas of that of the department for which they are responsible. But at the end of the day, it becomes a departmental report, and this is what this report on restitution is.
Thank you very much, ma'am. I want to remind you, you were here, ma'am, together with the commissioner in a meeting with us. We were complaining about the communication that you make to the public via the media. And most of the communication, in our view, was contradictory to each other. Sometimes you say something, and some arm of the department will say it's not necessarily true what you have said, because the true state of affairs is something else. Now, we wanted to know from you. That's why I insisted on the commissioner to give us a straight answer. Who is the owner of this report? Because if the department, through the DG and the minister, would say to us, that the cabinet decision must be tested in court, and that wherever you got, wherever the source of that comment is now coming from the department to us, we want to know whether that's your position as the department. Now you are saying it's the position of the commission. Ma'am, you have confirmed that the DG and the minister are part of this decision, that the cabinet decision must be tested in court.
Go ahead.
Chairperson, I think this part of the report must be clarified. Subsequent to the cabinet decision on KNP, there was a process which unfolded with the DG.
Can I help you, ma'am? Yes. I think you need help now. I do not want to entangle yourself the same way as the commissioner has done. You have said, yeah, and I think the DG has confirmed it twice. This report was not tabled to the DG and the minister for them to approve as a document to be tabled here. The DG cannot vouch that this report is a departmental report. I did not want to place the DG in the same position as I did to you. Now, I think the committee cannot accept this report, because it's not reflective of the position of the department. And therefore, we're sending it back. It must come back as a departmental report, which you can stand for and defend. Currently, you cannot defend it. You are passing it to the community now. There's no community here. It's the commissioner who presented this report. How can you present an opinion of the community when we're asking a report from the department? Did you? We do not want this report. We cannot place reliance on this report. Take it back and bring back a report that you can vouch for, which you can defend. This committee cannot be subjected to this kind of thing. Honorable Tillin.
Chairperson, I want to support you. This report is very, very depressing. I mean, it's impossible to digest everything that's been said in here. Yes, it does deal here and then with some solution and some recommendation. But really, I want to agree with you. It's a very bad note to end the year, of course, but this thing is very depressing. And if it's this what we are trying to do to a department that's supposed to be a priority function and a department for government, then really we have to think twice. But I want to support your motion. And can I be excused on that note,
Chairperson? No, we all have to leave, because there's a public hearing going on climate change. All of us must be there. But we prioritize this report together with all the issues relevant to it. And Commissioner, I really would want to give the DG the last word on this one. But the honorable members want to make a comment, and I will allow them first before Honorable Tillin is released.
Thanks, Chairperson. I don't forget that next time when we have meetings, the DG must ensure that he has seen all the documents that are coming to the house. Because once a document is presented for me, the person responsible for the report becomes the accounting officer. We shouldn't even be asking who drafted line 3 and who suggested line 4. You know, if the DG should take responsibility for this, and if there is to be any correction, it must be done by him. So we don't allow anything to be read in this house, unless if the DG says in the beginning of the meeting that before we start the meeting, I haven't seen a report of the technical division A and F. So if they are to make their presentation, the house must know that I have never seen those documents. So that we discuss it from the beginning, we could have cut this meeting short.
Honourable Swalit.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I also echo the very same sentiments because we actually given them the opportunity to present, but we also didn't hear actually the side of the DG as to whether is he actually knowing about this or not knowing about it. Because as the report was presented, we thought that the report was coming from the department. So if there is different views, maybe we could have actually hear the side from the DG as to whether he knows about this report or not. Thank you.
Honourable members, this is not a court. This is Parliament. Our responsibility is to make sure that what goes to Parliament is the truth and only the truth. If we get disclaimers in the report, what use is that report to us? It cannot be of use. That is why we're sending this report back. We want a report like Honourable Chabeleng is saying, that which was a product of the department. Not a product of the commission, which is a section of the department, as the commissioner is saying. That is why we want a report tabled here by the DG. Even if he sub-delegates that responsibility to one member of the delegation, but at least he can vouch for that report because the contents they have seen. Remember, I made the point here that the real reason why all these documents are circulated now is because the facilities in Parliament were not available. We could have seen this thing before it tabled here, if it was not circulated now. And then we could have raised this question to the DG before coming here. We could not, because we only circulated this document today, here in this meeting, and you yourself have not seen this document before today. The reason why I'm because it is easy for me to be irresponsible and say, let's take this report. You remember the journalists and other people will use this information as a true reflection of the information from the department, when it in fact is the opinion of a community, or a member of the community. It's not a report from the department. I would be acting irresponsibly if I did that. TG, your last word.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairperson. I must say that my understanding was that the questions that I read to you, which were four, were the ones that I was going to be responsible to respond to, and you probably corrected me that you need more. And I was not aware that this part was going to be part of our response today. So I want to appreciate your comments that this report must be referred back for discussion. So I accept that. I would like to look at the report before it is presented.
Thank you very much, Steve. Yes, Mamana.
Chairperson, I think you must be politically mature here. And don't pass the buck. I would like to support the person, the member who said that let's take a collective responsibility. Let's take a collective responsibility. What is a collective responsibility? Because several of these members are going to say their role in the public, including the minister himself. The minister should be sensitized about what is in this document, because he will be grieved by the media. It come from his department. You cannot actually, you know, the branch it will come from his department. It comes from his department. So which means it's something that he has approved himself. So next time, next time documents will come to us before. Documents must come to us before. You know, we can be here in front of us, not having gone through the documents itself. Documents must go through here, and so that we can be able to go through those documents, and then a collective responsibility must be taken. We're dealing with politics and people's lives. So, dealing with people's lives here. So, Chairperson, I'm begging that a collective decision and a responsibility must be taken. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Hanga. Ladies and gentlemen, there's a tape, or shall I say, CD. This CD is the response to the question that was raised by Honorable Abraham. Remember the average prices, statistics, and so on, other information. The information is now available for every member. Come and collect the CD here. It's available from the TG that answers the questions that were raised by Honorable Abraham. The minister wants to have a last word.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. I really appreciate the approach of the committee on the matter. It is a very embarrassing matter. Chair, the honorable member spoke before I spoke. Perhaps didn't say what I was going to say, nevertheless, that I take responsibility for this. I'm the political head of the department. So I'm not really responding to what she's saying. That's what I was going to say. Secondly, I knew what the DG was going to say here. I knew what the DG Shaban was going to say here, because we met before we came here. I asked them, we sat around like this, and I said, okay, what are they going to say, what are they going to say, what are they going to say. I mean, Commissioner Bella didn't say anything. So I'm saying it's not as if we just came out here and sat here. The practice in the department is that we take collective decisions. So it is really something that could have been avoided. Had he done all the things that other people did before we came here, so that we can say this thing is, you know, should be handled this way and that one should be handled that way, we could have withdrawn it. There's no doubt about it. The deputy president, the reason I'm speaking now is the third committee, that the deputy president has addressed the House on the matter. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't have expected that there would be a matter brought here and then dealt with in the manner that it was dealt with. If only, you know, when we had an opportunity. We agreed. We're going back now again to say, let's evaluate. That's the practice. Let's evaluate what happened there. That's the practice. I brought here the response of the president, of the deputy president. The DG has got a copy there. I've got a copy here. I said the deputy president had responded to this one at some point. And what holds there for is the response of the deputy president, which he presented to the House on the question of Kruger National Park. And I take responsibility for what the commissioner has done under my charge in this meeting. Finally, Chair, thank you very, very much. I really appreciate the manner in which the committee has handled the matter. Thank you very, very much.
Honorable members, it concludes the business of our committee. What we are going to be doing, we are going to interact with the information given to us, PG. We have indicated that whatever is the outstanding matter will be included in the strategic plan. We will not call you back to the committee now. When we table our reports to Parliament, whether they are outstanding matters or not, we will reflect in our report our own findings. and recommendations for Parliament to adopt. What perhaps we will do, we will continue to interact with you on those outstanding matters so that when we table them in Parliament, there will be no dispute, there will be no disclaimer, there will be nobody pleading ignorance of anything that we will be tabling in Parliament. So we will come back to you, DG, on this particular matter and all other outstanding matters. But we know that when we deal with the strategic plan of the department for the next financial year, that is the area perhaps where we are going to be ironing out all these outstanding matters. And for now, I think in as far as the annual report of the commission, annual report of the department, and annual report of the Ngonyama Trust, leave it in our hands. We will process and table in Parliament. Thank you very much. Honourable members, interact with the document so that tomorrow somebody must not ask us questions that have already been answered. If you have any outstanding matter, we have already said we don't climb on mountaintop and blow trumpets. We interact constructively. We have agreed on a constructive engagement. Honorable Swate, the Shadow Minister of Rural Development, has an understanding with me, including his deputy. Thank you very much. The meeting is at the end.
Thank you.